Yeah, don't we wish that Friday was our day to play, huh? Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Nova M Radio Network. Thanks for tuning in on a Friday night. Hope you're going to stick around for a while. All right. Lots of ground to cover tonight. We always do, don't we? We're going to be taking a lot of phone calls tonight, too. Here, I want to hear what you've got to say.
Yeah, he always says that.
Michael Steele, former lieutenant. Governor of Maryland, is that right? Michael Steele has been named the new chairman of the Republican National Committee. The fact that he is an African American is curious indeed. Not the fact that he's an African American, but the fact that he's an African American who has been selected by the Republican National Committee to be the chairman of the Republican Party. No. There's nothing there except an honest desire on the part of the Republicans to, as they always have done, to find the best man, regardless of, you know, skin color. We'll get to that in a minute because I got an email from a woman named Kaya who says she's African-American in her early 30s. So I'll read that to you in a second. I guess you're aware that the first bill, the first honest-to-God bill that worked its way through Congress that Barack Obama signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Play Act, right? Now, Lilly Ledbetter, an Alabama woman, was the whose story was the impetus behind this new law. And she was there when Obama signed this, the first bill of his presidency. What the bill does is nullify a 2007 Supreme Court decision that denied this woman an opportunity for redress. Redress for what? Well, she's 70 years old now, and she worked for 19 years at Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company in Gadsden, Alabama. 19 years. During that entire time, she didn't know that the difference in pay between her, what she was paid and what her male counterparts were paid, was huge. There was a huge discrepancy, sizable discrepancy. She sued, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled 5-4 that she missed her chance to bring the action because the High Court, and you can imagine who the five judges that voted against her. They were the five judges that voted to stop the not all five because Roberts wasn't there. I guess Alito wasn't either. But of the same philosophical bent as the five who stopped the voting in Bush v. Gore. But the court said that in order to have a legitimate claim, someone who fell under this equal pay thing had to file their claim within 180 days. Of a company's initial decision to pay a worker less than another worker doing the same job, 180 days. Now, you can imagine that Lilly Ledbetter was hired some 21, 22 years ago. And, of course, the first thing she did was walk around and ask her male counterparts, sir, how much are you getting paid? Over there, how much are you getting paid? Oh, Jesus. Now, Ledbetter won't benefit from the legislation. It gets her nothing, even though it probably cost her about $250,000 over the course of her working life. Roughly $250,000 is what she lost. She gets nothing. But as she said, the rich's reward here is that the nation's daughters and granddaughters will have a better deal. And she said that's what makes this fight worth fighting. Opponents, all Republicans, except for, I think, three Democrats in the House, contended that the bill would gut the statute of limitations and benefit trial lawyers. Yo, trial lawyers are going to win. You ever notice how every time a Republican gets busted for something like child molestation or criminal activity that they always hire a trial lawyer, right? You ever notice that? Anyway, they said the law will benefit trial lawyers by encouraging lawsuits. And they also argued, this Republican scum, that employees could wait to file claims in hopes of reaping larger damage rewards, right? So they find out they're being paid less, and they just accept it and then sit back in the bushes and wait and wait and wait and then leap out and surround the company and the executives and say, I want my money, I want my money, I want my money. The fact is, the bill does not change current law limiting back pay awards to 2 years, so there's no incentive to wait to file a claim. But remember, Republicans never, ever tell the truth about anything. When he signed this bill, Obama cited Census Bureau figures that show women still earn about 78 cents for every dollar men get for doing equivalent jobs. It's even less for women of color. Lilly Ledbetter, by the way, is white. So anyway, we did some checking, and we found that every male Republican in the Senate passed the bill 61-36 a couple of days ago. Week ago, every male Republican except Arlen Specter voted against it. Every male Republican, I should say white male Republican, but they're all white. Every male Republican in the Senate except Arlen Specter voted against this. In the House, 244 Democrats said, yeah, let's have equal pay for equal work. 5 Democrats said no. In the House, 3 Republicans said, yeah, let's have equal pay for equal work. 166 Republicans said, no, let's not have equal pay for equal work. Goddamn women, they're supposed to stay home. What the hell are they out here working for anyway? Why would anyone vote for Republicans under any circumstances? Why would a woman, why would a female American ever, under any circumstances, whether she's married or single, gay or straight, has children or does not have children, why would a Republican, a woman, ever vote Republican? Can somebody just call in with an answer to that? I'll take you right away. We'll put you ahead of number one in the queue if you have an answer. Why? And not the obvious stuff, like because they're religiously abused or they are battered by their right-wing Republican husbands. Of course that occurs. Of course that occurs. But I'm talking about a woman who may not have brainwashing. Is that it? What makes a woman vote Republican under any circumstances? Of course, I can extend that and say what makes anyone vote Republican under any circumstances. Oh, my God. It just never stops, does it? Now, let me read what Kaya wrote. I got this email shortly after it was announced that Michael Steele had been made the head of the Republican National Committee. Hi, Mike. Love your show. I listen to you every night. I am an educated African-American woman in her early 30s who cannot find anyone to voice my frustration to upon hearing that Michael Steele has been chosen to head the RNC. I hope that you will understand why I am venting. I am so sick and blankety-blank tired of my people being treated like a bunch of stupid, gullible dummies. The decision to name this Uncle Tom is merely a, quote, token, end quote, gesture by the good old boys because they realize their party cannot attack black and brown people, especially with the cultural map of America changing the way it is. They killed 2 birds with 1 stone. They can put Steele against Obama and possibly bring so-called minorities to the party. Well, I believe this will backfire big time. If President Obama had not won the election, would they have chosen Steele? Hell no. Do you honestly think we do not know that? Thank you for letting me vent. Once again, I love you and Kathy. By the way, one good thing did come out of it. Hopefully this will cause the big fat racist Russia's head to finally explode. Kaya. Thanks, Kaya. I don't know anything about Michael Steele. But I know, I don't know what his legislative record, or I think he was, wasn't he in the Maryland House or something? Or and then he became lieutenant. I know nothing. I know zero about him. And really don't need to know anything because I want the Republican Party, to be murdered. I want someone to sneak in at night wherever the Republican Party sleeps. And I want 6 or 7 masked men to sneak in with long knives and stab it to death. That's what I want as far as the Republican Party is concerned. Now, Michael Steele, I don't know him from Adam's house cat, but I do know Republicans. They're hypocrites, liars, sneaks. They hate black people. They hate brown people. They hate immigrants. And the reason they hate them is because they're terrified of them. They hate women because they're terrified of them. They hate everything. They hate everything about this country. They have never voted for any act that would be considered progressive or any act that would be considered in the best interest of the country. So selection or the election, however they do it, I don't even care. Don't even write me and tell me. However Michael Steele became the head of the RNC, I'll go with Kaya since she can comment on that and I can't. And I'll go with her comment that he's an Uncle Tom, and this was another act of gross hypocrisy on the part of the Republican Party.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more Mike Malloy.
Things got rough, things got tough, things got harder than high. 22 past the hour. We were just trying to make a Oh, there's Mark Green, Air America president on Rachel's program. Hey, Mark, where's my $120,000 you owe me, you son of a bitch? Hey, Mark Green, over here. Mike Malloy, where's my money?
Maybe Rachel can get it for you. You ought to call her.
All right. Yeah, well, hold on a minute. I'll do it after the show. What a thug. Look at this guy. This is from Howard, who writes, Mike, you recall that during the presidential election, Rush Limbaugh and his diddle heads in Congress and Fox News did and said everything to discredit Barack Obama because he was African-American. In fact, as I'm sure you remember, loudmouth Limbaugh said loudly and repeatedly that Colin Powell only endorsed Barack Obama because he was black. Now, with it being obvious, the Republicans elected Michael Steele as the new RNC head because he is black. Do you think loudmouth Rush will repeat what he said about Colin Powell's endorsement of Barack Obama? I think not. Howard writes, also, if the Republicans really believe that Michael Steele will encourage significant numbers of blacks and other minorities to vote Republican, they are sorely mistaken. It's the same reason that they put Sarah Palin on the Republican ticket after Hillary Clinton did not become the Democratic Party's nominee, right? Everything Republicans do is hypocritical, slimy. It's a lie. Every piece of legislation they vote for is against the best wishes of the people of this country. Every piece of legislation they vote against would have benefited huge numbers of Americans. It is the nature of Republicans. The Republican Party needs to be murdered. It needs to be killed. It would be a mercy killing for the rest of this country. It needs to be murdered in its sleep. It really does. Okay, our daily bit of good news from Bruce Enberg, our economic affairs advisor, or as he is affectionately known here on the Malloy program, Prairie 2, who writes, Mike, the GDP for last quarter, it was announced, dropped 3.8%, and the corporate newsreaders were cackling that the economists were wrong because they predicted that the drop would be 5.5%. But, of course, they aren't telling you the bad news. The GDP didn't drop more because manufacturers and wholesalers continue to pile up inventory. This will mean the rate of decline will continue to pick up speed as companies are forced to deal with it, and gross domestic product will contract faster. If they are forced to start dumping inventory, this will trigger deflation, or in simple terms, another Great Depression. A stopped clock is right twice a day, but Republicans find it much harder to hit a correct answer, and never for the right reason. They are right that Obama's stimulus won't fix the economy, but not for any reason they give. Obama needs to do much more, but nothing the Republicans want. Psst, hey, rich Republicans, he probably won't be cutting your taxes. And why should he? The top 400 taxpayers only pay an average of 17%. Obama needs to raise wages for the little guys, and he's going to piss off the Chinese. They are already foaming at the mouth and will blow a gasket when they find out he's not just cheap talk like they are used to from the Bush crime family. Obama will need to get a handle on the banks and markets before he goes after the Chinese. Bank holidays are a real prospect. It would be a good idea to keep some cash under the mattress and, dare I say it, canned goods. You won't get any warning if this happens. Here's a little historical trivia for you. Check writing became much more common in the 30s because, because of a lack of cash in the banks. Meanwhile, poor ExxonMobil saw its profits decline sharply in the last quarter, making only $8 billion in 3 months, reducing its yearly total to only $45 billion, the most by any company at any time, anywhere on the planet. Prairie 2.
The Mike Malloy Show, because each time you listen to Right Wing Radio, God kills a kitten.
It's about 25 before the hour. All right, Barack Obama today, once again, had to, not had to, but found it within the realm of his duties as president to talk about the economy and what is happening. You know, what the Republicans have left us, we've talked about this before, is a steaming pile of dog droppings. And I hope Obama can get us out of this. I know Clinton got us out of what Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush handed off. But it was nothing like this, so we'll see. But anyway, Obama and Biden reacted to this ever-shrinking economy today when these new numbers came out and talked a little bit about their plan to try to protect the vast majority of Americans while enacting reforms on Wall Street to curb these executive bonuses. Can you believe these sons of bitches? You talk about arrogance. The executives who have come with their genitals in their hands almost begging for help from you and me, they stand there like a bunch of little boys who say, "Oh, I need more money, mommy." And like crazy people, the Bush crime family gave it to them. Paulson and Bernanke made sure, that these capitalist criminals were given exactly what they want, no accounting, nothing. And then what these weasels do is turn around and pay each other enormous bonuses in the billions. I mean, I can't think of any other society where, if this were to happen, the people who did it would not be immediately taken out on the street and shot. No trial. No rendering of a jury. The evidence is, the whole thing is in what they did. Give us money. We're going bankrupt and we're too big to fail. Thank you. Here, boys. Here. Here's another billion. Here's another billion. These people are dumber than dog snot. Here's some more. Here's some more. Yeah, they would be dragged out into the street and shot. Right? Of course they would. Of course they would. But here, oh, they're masters of the universe. Oh, they're Republicans. Oh, you're not supposed to interfere with the free market. Free market, my ass. We've not had a free market in this country since the 20s. Or before. I'm talking about the 1920s. Anyway, here's Obama today trying.
We need to create jobs, but not just any jobs. We need to create jobs that sustain families and sustain dreams. Jobs in new and growing industries. Jobs that don't feel like a dead end, but a way forward and a way up. Jobs that will foster a vibrant and growing middle class. Because the strength of our economy can be measured directly by the strength of our middle class. And that's why I've created the Task Force on Middle Class Working Families. And why I've asked my Vice President, Joe Biden, to lead it. This task force will bring together my economic advisors and members of my cabinet to focus on policies that will really benefit the middle class. Policies to create jobs that pay well and provide a chance to save. To create jobs in growing fields and train workers to fill them. To ensure that workplaces are safe and fair, as well as flexible for employees juggling the demands of work and family.
Of course, the phrase that he keeps using that Republicans hate is the phrase, the two-word phrase, middle class. The Republicans have never wanted a middle class. They want the ruling class and the workers. Middle class, schmiddle class. What the hell is that? Is that some communist term? To the bankers and the corporate thugs, yeah, it's communism. It's socialism. It's redistribution of wealth downward. As long as it goes upward, it's okay. It's okay. That, after all, is what capitalism is all about. The redistribution of wealth upward. Up, always upward. And the depression of workers' wages, the depression of the workers. Middle class, my ass. There is to be a working class, and they will be borderline serfs and the corporate class. But he says, Obama says, because the strength of our economy can be measured directly by the strength of our middle class. You see, the Chamber of Commerce types and National Association of Manufacturing types and the Republicans and the drug-addled, drug-pushing, snot-breathing thugs like Rush Limbaugh, no. They disagree. The strength of our economy can be measured directly by the strength of the upper 2%. If the upper 2% in terms of wealth are satisfied, fat, and happy, and can vacation any place they want to on Earth, any time they want to, then we're okay! Any situation different from that is not okay. It's communism. Oh, God, I get sick of these people. Obama then explained his plan to strengthen unions. It's hard to believe, really, after 8 years of raisin brain, that we have a president who is even slightly pro-labor.
I also believe that we have to reverse many of the policies towards organized labor that we've seen these last 8 years, policies with which I've sharply disagreed. I do not view the labor movement as part of the problem. To me, it's part of the solution. We need...
Uh-oh.
We need to level the playing field for workers and the unions that represent their interests. Because we know that you cannot have a strong middle class without a strong labor movement. We know that strong, vibrant, growing unions can exist side by side with strong, vibrant, and growing businesses. So I'm going to be signing three executive orders designed to ensure that federal contracts serve taxpayers efficiently and effectively. One of these orders is going to prevent taxpayer dollars from going to reimburse federal contractors who spend money trying to influence the formation of unions.
Well, I don't view the labor movement as part of the problem. To me, it's part of the solution. And that deserves the applause. But when he says we need to level the playing field to the right wing, you see, that's communism! As the inestimably crazy and unlearned Sarah Palin said during the primary campaign, well, that's socialism, redistribution of wealth, that's social, redistribution, that's social, And when he talks about a strong middle class with a strong labor movement, oh, my God, that's right out of Das Kapital, isn't it? Isn't that right out of the Marxist handbook? Oh, my God, strong middle class with a strong labor movement? And then he says, we know that strong, vibrant, growing unions, he uses that phrase, strong, vibrant, growing unions, oh, my God, oh, my God, they'll strike, they'll demand livable wages. They'll want time off and vacations and sick pay and time and a half for overtime. Oh, my God, no. Quick. Close the factory. Ship it to China. So he's going to be signing three executive orders. I think he did today. Designed to try to pump a little oxygen into this moribund union movement in this country. The union membership is growing, I understand. So good for Obama. Good for Obama. Now, is this all from yesterday, all of these sound bites from yesterday? No, two of them are from today. This is from yesterday when Obama met with his new Secretary of the Treasury and spoke to the press about the dire need to reform Wall Street in order to get the country out of this mess that the Bush crime family and the Republicans have created.
One point I want to make. Is that all of us are going to have responsibilities to get this economy moving again. And when I saw an article today indicating that Wall Street bankers had given themselves $20 billion worth of bonuses, the same amount of bonuses as they gave themselves in 2004, at a time when most of these institutions were teetering on collapse, and they are asking for taxpayers to help sustain them. And when taxpayers find themselves in the difficult position that if they don't provide help, that the entire system could come down on top of our heads, that is the height of irresponsibility. It is shameful. And part of what we're going to need is for the folks on Wall Street who are asking for help to show some restraint and show some discipline and show some sense of responsibility.
Oh.
You know, the American people understand that we've got a big hole that we've got to dig ourselves out of, but they don't like the idea that people are digging a bigger hole even as they're being asked to fill it up.
Now, what he just said there, we just played for you 1 minute and 23 seconds. And I want to comment on that when we come back. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
You're gonna rise up righteous. You're gonna spread your wings. You're gonna retake the sky. But until that morning, they're gonna work you for peanuts.
Has he mentioned yet tonight how much he hates these people? It's more of Mike Malloy.
It's 10 before the hour. All right, that little soundbite we played right before the break where Obama speaks out against the $20 billion worth of bonuses these predatory vampiric bastards paid themselves out of money that supposedly we all kicked in under the Bush crime family's firm and loving hand. We kicked it in order to prevent these businesses that are too big to fail from failing. And what did they do? $20 billion in bonuses. Do you know what $20 billion would do for schools or children's health care or, medical research or people who are homeless or people on Medicaid who desperately need kidney transplants or whatever? You know what $20 billion would do? What are these rapacious bastards going to do with the $20 billion, huh? Buy another jet? Take another cruise? Spend more money on another house, another 140,000 square foot mansion someplace? This is the kind of stuff, if it continues, and Barack Obama may have got elected just in time, because this is the stuff that bloody revolutions are made from. This sort of thing. When income disparity reaches these levels, you don't believe me? Ask the French. Ask them what happened in the 1790s. Ask, you know, go anywhere. Look at your own history book. You know exactly what we're talking about here. All right. So Obama, the bit we played is 1 minute and 23 seconds of airtime. That's it. Now, how much of what he said in that minute 23 that we just played for you did you hear on network newscasts or on cable newscasts? I'm not talking about if one of them carried the entire speech live. I'm talking about as it became a news clip, because not everybody can plunk their ass down in front of a television all day and catch everything that CNN or MSNBC may put out there. So of the minute 23, how much made it to the nightly news? Give up? 17 seconds. How much made it to the cable news channels during the day, other than live coverage, if it even occurred? I don't know. How much made it? 20 seconds? 25? A minute 23 for Barack Obama to make a very clear, concise declaration of fact. He says, one point I want to make is that all of us are going to have responsibilities to get this economy moving again. You see, there we go again. There's another communist slogan. All of us are going to have responsibilities, right? That's communism to the likes of the pig man, the drug-addled, obese, snot-eating Rush Limbaugh, who sends his housekeeper out to score drugs for him, who is now the spokesperson, the head of the Republican Party, Michael Steele be damned. Is that his name, Michael? I don't even know. I really don't care. I think it's Michael. The real head of the Republican Party is a drug-addled freak named Rush Limbaugh. So as Rush Limbaugh will tell you, any time that you hear the phrase, all of us are going to have responsibilities, well, now that's communism. That's communism. And when he says folks on Wall Street who are asking for help to show some restraint and show some discipline and show some a sense of responsibility, he says that's what we're going to need. Well, that's communism. You see, because the folks on Wall Street or the investment community on the controlling end or the financial services industry, they are beyond, you see, the law. They are beyond law that's on the books in terms of criminal law, but they're also beyond economic law, the laws of economics. They exist someplace else. They can set up Ponzi schemes. They can sell instruments that are worth a pile of owl crap. They can convince people to buy debt. They can convince people to go into debt, horrendous debt. There is nothing honorable about the financial industry or the financial services industry or the banking industry in this country. Nothing is honorable about it. Nothing. Not a thing. You want honor in the flow and control of money? Take a look at credit unions. Jesus, I'm drawing blank after blank tonight. It must be, I don't know. Must be all those drugs I did when I was in my 20s. But take a look at a credit union, how a credit union operates. Banks are predatory. Credit unions are part of a community. I've said this a million times before. But if you think for a moment, for one moment, that the financial services industry has the interest of the little investor at heart. Well, Mike, what about investing in stocks? That's wonderful. No, that's called gambling. That's called a casino. Do you really think, do you really honestly believe that the stock market flows up and flows down based on investment capitalization ratio of debt to profit and loss, to the productivity of the company, all that stuff that we were taught in school. Do you think that's how the stock market works? If you do, you're a goddamn fool, and you deserve to be fleeced just like the rest of the sheep. That's not how the stock market works at all. It is run. It is run by people who know how to manipulate it. Let's make a profit today and a loss tomorrow. You see, but eventually it gets out of control, as it has gotten out of control. The huge investors, the huge individual investors, I'm not talking about the institutional investors, they take a bath too. They take a beating too. Just like everybody I know, everybody, myself including, my little 401k, or what was it? Was that a 401k? No, it wasn't a 401k. What was it? What did I have? IRAs that were invested in emerging market funds and domestic market. And I, when I finally hit 35 or 40% losses this year, my accountant said, "Get out!" And I did, because of my age. Somebody in their 20s or 30s might be able to last another 30 years until it comes back up, but not moi. I don't have that much time left. So anyone who thinks that the little investor, people like me, who only wound up in the market because we had 401ks back in the day when they were matched by your employer. And when you leave the employment, you have to roll it into something. So you roll it into an IRA, and the IRA goes into a fund, into an investment fund. And we just kind of forgot about it. We'd get our statements every 90 days or whatever. And I started noticing, Jesus God, it's disappearing. Don't ever think that you, as a small investor, have anything to say about how the stock market works, because you don't. Just put your money down and watch the croupier spin the wheel. Welcome back. It's 7 past the hour. A couple of emails here. I want to share with you. First is from Michael in Long Beach, California, who mentioned something that we have not brought up for some time, and I feel kind of remiss in this. Michael writes, "Dear Mike, maybe there is time to mention Bob Alexander at superbeans.com, his efforts regarding the Prosecute George Bush for Murder campaign on one of your upcoming shows. I'm not sure how their funds are, but I'll bet they could use a little help on the donation front, especially from those of us who can't be there to stuff the books or do any heavy lifting. We contributed to the effort, continue to do so, but staying on the minds of the listeners / contributors even briefly will ensure success for Bob and everyone helping out on the ground. We try to listen as much as we can, and if you've done this recently, please forgive us. We just haven't heard it for a while and thought it might be a good refresher. Thanks and continued success. Fight the oligarchs, drive them into the sea. All the best, Michael in Long Beach." What he's talking about, if you don't know, of course, is the campaign put together by three people in Seattle, Bob Alexander's wife, Arminda, and Jude from Women Standing, a peace organization. And Vince Bugliosi, his book, Prosecuting George W. Bush for Murder, or The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, lays out a very simple plan on how to get this son of a bitch. And Bob had a flash several months ago, after having read the book, that every prosecutor, every county prosecutor in the country should get a copy of the book, because this is where it's going to have to come from. Obviously, the Obama administration, for whatever reason, is not going to pursue this. So it falls on the shoulders of county prosecutors in counties where any one or a hundred or whatever the number is, soldiers were taken into the joined the U.S. military and fought in war that was constructed under false pretenses against the law. George W. Bush is guilty of the murder of close to, how many is it now? We're up to 5,000 dead Americans and countless numbers of dead Iraqis, Afghans, so on and so forth. Okay. So when we mentioned this on the air a couple of months ago, looking for donations, all of a sudden Bob got enough money to get this thing started. Then he got a huge discount just when it looked like it wasn't going to happen. He was like 29 grand short. The publisher cut him a deal, and all of a sudden he was only 2,900 short. And then money started coming in again. And as far as I know, I've seen some pictures that are out on the Internet. He's been interviewed on a couple of radio programs. I've seen huge boxes that are stacks of boxes put together that they're mailing out to all the county prosecutors. So if you are still inclined to throw another $5-$10 his way or their way, he and his wife and Jude, then go to superbeans.com. That's all. Superbeans.com. That's his website because he's in the coffee import business. And as an aside, you know, we've been getting coffee from him now for what? How long, Kathy? Year and a half? 2 years? How long has it been? There's nothing like the coffee. I mean, that's just, you know. But so go to superbeans.com if you have a moment. Or if you already are well aware of what Bob Alexander's doing, then and can toss another $5 in the hat. If you got it, I mean, you know, we know the reality. We know the reality. But if you got another $5 that you can toss his way for postage, for I mean, this is all being done by volunteers. Primarily, the heavy work is Bob and Arminda and Jude. But it's my understanding a couple of people have in the Seattle area have thrown in. So, oh, I just got an email from him. He says, how much more money do we need? $550. That's it? Okay. He says, the big stuffing party is tomorrow. So I guess that's when they're going to start or continue stuffing these envelopes. Oh, that's right. The big cartons I saw were pallets of the stuff sent to him through UPS or FedEx or somebody from the publisher. Pallets of these books. And they had to open them up, break them down, address, and I won't even go into it. Hopefully, what Alexander will do at some point, he will write a piece that will wind up in Harper's or New Yorker or someplace, you know, a 10,000-word essay or story about what happened. Suffice it to say that they have just busted their asses doing this. So, $550? Okay. So if I have 100 listeners who throw in $6, home free. So just go to superbeans.com and all the information will be there. You know, if you can. If you can't do it, don't feel guilty about it. But if you can, there you go. Oh, wait. My bad. Don't go to superbeans.com. Go to prosecutegeorgebush.com. That's right. Prosecute George Bush. Okay. Superbeans.com is where you get a nice cup of coffee. Prosecutegeorgebush.com. That was a website he set up to handle all this. And I think there's a PayPal button there. Prosecutegeorgebush.com. All right. Oh my God. Go Bob. And like I say, at some point, I think he's, he may have been writing about this, all the way, you know, keeping a running tab or something. I don't know. I think that's how it started out, but they got so damn busy. You know, plus they have to work in order to pay the rent or the mortgage payment. I'm not sure. I had some Asian food with them when I was out to Seattle the last time with Bob and Arminda and their son Nick. Nick had a flying monkey with him and on a rubber band, and you pull it back and shoot it. And it scared the hell out of Nick. I brought it home. Molly loved it, but I don't blame Nick. Scared the hell out of me, too. And then Patty wrote this. I'm just going to put this in because she asked me to. Hello, Mike and Kathy. I just needed to thank you both oh so much for your ranting, raving, screeching, stories, poems, commercials, and occasional quirkiness. You speak to my heart and also provide a tremendous amount of humor. Mike, I love it when you provide commentary over a press-released soundbite. It makes me laugh. Thank you for the comic relief. You're both great. Patty, P.S., please read this on the air. My fellow truth seekers would probably like to hear that you are recognized for your humor. Thank you. Well, thank you, Patty. All right. Let me see what else we got here. Who do we have on hold? Let's do some phone calls. It's about 15 past the hour. We have to break here in a second, but let's go to Mike in Alabama first. Mike's listening on Sirius. Hey, Mike.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I've been listening to you since New Orleans, Chicago, and
oh my goodness.
never called your show. I heard your show last night, mm-hmm. and thought all day about it. I was in the chaplain corps during the Desert Storm and, in the Army and,
mm-hmm.
saw a lot of what went on and, that, the suicide thing, it struck a chord with me.
Right.
And,
let me just jump in. Mike, what Mike's referring to is a report from the Army, and the Marines, suicide among veterans, Army is the highest it's ever been. The Marine Corps is starting to slide up also. These are essentially young people who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan, who have had multiple deployments, and they come back. They're suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. They're looking for help. They're not getting it, and a lot of these folks are winding up killing themselves.
That's right. The thing that I saw over there, Mike, there were, after the war was over, everyone saw the death and the destruction, and the reality started to set in, some sooner and others later. But there were basically three types of soldiers, and first type, I'll just call those the Rambos or Chuck right. Norrises. And that's how they chose to deal with it. And the majority of your soldiers, they lean sort of on their own spirituality, whatever that was.
Hey, can I get you to hold on just a second, Mike?
Sure.
All right, let me put you on hold because I got to do a break here. I'll put you on hold. We'll come back and because the audience wants to hear what you got to say. Mike is a former chaplain in the United States Army. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M.
I call upon the world's millions. No more war in our name. Stop this madness. Stop the killing. Stop the suffering and the pain. So I don't want to be a soldier. I don't want to
It's 22 past the hour. We're talking with Mike in Alabama, who was a former Army chaplain. All right, Mike, you started to tell us three types of soldiers you would come in contact with. Start that again, will you?
Okay. The first type, well, let me start and say that all these men, they, young men, they come in the military, and to a man, they're patriotic. And they go in with the belief that they're serving their country and they're doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And after they got into the combat and saw what had happened, they dealt with it in a different way. I saw three different types. And like I said, the first type was the Rambo type who, you know, we really did our job and, mm-hmm. you know, we're successful and that's it. Fortunately, that wasn't the majority. Most of the guys, they saw it for what it was, the death and the destruction. And, it worked on them and they questioned why they were there and if it was right. And, those were the fellows that dealt with it, like I say, in a normal way, if there is such a thing for that.
Right.
And then the third type, these were the guys that, they really had no coping skills to start with.
Mm-hmm.
And, they didn't know, they didn't have anywhere to turn to. They wouldn't talk to anyone about it. And, they became a danger not only to themselves, but to the other men.
Mm-hmm.
And, when we would identify one of those fellows, they would be ostracized, by the command. And they were made to feel bad.
Mm.
And they would put them in positions, that, they didn't want to be in.
Mm.
So we learned, be sensitive to that. You know, is it better to identify them or is it better to try and, you know, find somebody to work with?
Let me, if you don't mind my interrupting, why would they be put in positions where they would be isolated from, why not go to, well, obviously, to the chaplain, to you? I mean, why would command put them in an isolated situation?
No, they would ostracize them.
The command, or the other soldiers would, or?
The command would make it seem to the rest of the soldiers, the command was the brain center.
Right.
Okay, and the soldiers believe what they're told.
Right.
And this is where the problems came in, is like, whenever it was over and we saw the destruction and the death, that's when reality set in. Hey, you know, maybe mm-hmm. what this is all about isn't what it's all cracked up to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, then, you know, like I'm saying, this third group of fellows, they had poor coping skills before
right.
they were
right.
in the military. And, when they would be identified as a possible danger, the command would ostracize them, and in other words, they would try and tell the rest of the troops that, well, he's not a good soldier,
oh,
or, you know, this sort of thing. So that just worsened the matter.
Mm-hmm.
So we really had to dance around that subject, and I know that those are the guys who are committing the suicide.
I see.
Because they've got it inside themselves, and they can't let it out. And, the best thing for them to do, I've thought about this all day, the thing for them to do, if you're listening, go to your local VFW or your local American Legion and tell them who you are, that you're a combat veteran and you need to speak to another combat veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And what these folks will do, they will put you in contact or someone will come and talk to you, and there'll be, like a support system for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's available. It doesn't cost a penny and you can start it tomorrow.
Hey, I've got another break, but Mike, I want to ask you, hold on one more time because there's something I want to ask you directly. Do you mind holding on again?
Sure.
Okay. Let me put you on hold for a second. We're talking with a former Army chaplain. His name is Mike. He's called in from Alabama. We're going to take a break. And we'll come back and talk further with Mike. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. 25 before the hour. This is the Malloy Show. All right, we were talking with Mike, who is a former Army chaplain, listening on Sirius, called in from Alabama. All right, Mike, you were telling us about these three different types of combat people that you'd run into, and your feeling that the ones who had no coping skills before they entered the military are the ones that are suffering the most severely when they come out, and the ones that are probably contributing to this high number of suicides. So have I got that right?
Correct.
All right. The one question I wanted to ask you, how did you cope?
Good question. Well, look, Mike, I'm very liberal, and just tell you about my politics for a brief second. I'm a consented supporter. I voted for Nader. That's my politics. My theology is very literal, which may seem like a paradox, but it's really not, because if you really understand Jesus, he was probably the chief liberal.
Oh yeah, okay. I have no argument with that.
Okay, and I had to get out of the Army after that. To borrow Leonard's line, I couldn't run no more with that lawless crowd.
Mm-hmm.
While those killers in high places,
right,
said their prayers out loud.
Really?
And right, I mean it worked on me. I had my faith, and the way that I coped with it was by just throwing myself totally into the men and their situation and their grief and the way that they were dealing with it. And through all of that, my own spirituality was strengthened, and I was given a peace. And that was just me. And that was not the chaplain's core creed and how to do it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't even want to go there.
Right.
But you asked me, and I was not a very good fit for the chaplain corps.
Well, I got to tell you, Mike, as I listen to you here, and I'm sure a lot of the audience is picking up on this too, you sound like you have a heavy burden on you. And so how are you coping now?
Well, right now... And I'm at peace with this. I talk like with you. I talk every day with different people, not about myself, but about them and how they've coped with different things, in the grieving process of coming to reality of being used. And that is one of the things that really hurts the most is, like I said earlier, these soldiers to a man were patriotic.
Mm-hmm.
And that was their main reason for joining, not to go to college, not to shoot a gun,
right,
but to be patriotic. And then when they understood after it was all said and done that they were used.
Mm.
Okay.
Oh, God.
That's what really works on your mind, because no, it was not a patriotic act. We were used.
Well, I'm kind of at a loss for words. I mean, I don't know what to say, except if you listen to this program regularly, I hope that what you hear doesn't offend you.
It doesn't, Mike. It doesn't.
All right. And I also hope that you'll occasionally call in when the Spirit moves you, because you've got insight that regarding a battlefield that and what happens to people there, that so few of us in this generation, I mean this period of time, not just my generation, because I'll bet you I'm older than you are, but the generation that went through World War II is practically all dead. The generation of Korea is rapidly disappearing. So what do we got here? We got Vietnam, and then all the little brush fire wars that U.S. soldiers have been involved in the past 40 years. But because there has been no universal conscription or draft for the past, 35 years or however long it's been, that collective understanding in this country of what it really means to go into the military and pick up a rifle or a weapon or whatever and actually get involved in either support or actual combat, very few people have that in the society now. I remember in my lifetime where damn near everybody had that knowledge.
Right.
And if one individual himself or herself didn't, then there was a cousin, a brother, an uncle. I had one, two, three, four. I had five male members of my immediate family who served in the military. But
right.
you don't find that anymore. So,
I wouldn't let my son serve.
Well, I hear that. I hear that loud and clear. My son wanted to join the Navy, and my brother-in-law, who is my son's uncle, who had been a naval officer, talked him out of it. Out of it. So, anyway, I hope you'll stay in touch, and I appreciate you taking time to call in here. Okay.
Yeah, Mike, I enjoy your show. You know, your voice needs to be heard. You bring up a lot of valid points that we don't get to hear anywhere else. And you're really one of the few talk shows that I listen to. But I do listen to you, and like I say, I've listened to you since I found you in Chicago.
Good Lord. That's a long time.
I'm a child of the 70s, okay?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I lived in the 60s. I was born in 55.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm not that young. I'm one of the little older guys over there in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
But, I can only do that, like I said, for about 8 years and had to get away from it. It was just, when I understood what was going on, and I understood a lot sooner than the rest of the fellows, I would think.
Right.
The briefings I got to set in on and the things I heard, and then to see everything come to fruition, and then the debriefings, it hit you like a ton of bricks. And, like I say, you know, when you come to that realization, you have to make choices, and is this where I'm needed? Is this where I want to be?
Mm-hmm.
And I was definitely needed there at that time. And I feel that, I did the job that I was to do at that time,
mm-hmm.
but I knew I didn't want to be there after that.
I hear that. I hear that loud and clear. Mike, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. Okay.
Okay.
All right, sir. Take care. Take care. Wow. That's real true about the shared experience of the military and the society is gone. It's gone. I don't know if that's good or bad. I'm just saying. it used to be, didn't it? I mean, you know, you grew up in that time. If you're over a certain age. If you were born in the 50s, or even the 60s, and you work back from that, you know, generation, when there was universal military service, not that everybody served, think of our president and vice president, but of the former president and vice president, not that everybody served, but everybody knew, men anyway, knew. Because it was only men that were being drafted, every man knew that the chances of his going into the military service was there. When the lottery happened in the 60s, you knew real quick if you were going to go in because of whatever lottery number you got. But there was a shared experience where it concerned knowledge of the military. That is gone now. That is gone. People who serve in the military, the horrors that soldiers go through, nobody hears about except their families and their counselor and maybe their spiritual advisor. Nobody hears about it anymore. You see, Bush and Cheney made damn sure of that. So. It's because we don't have that shared awareness. We have been in Iraq and Afghanistan now for 8 years. Afghanistan is going to eventually become is rapidly becoming, if it isn't already, the longest military engagement that the U.S. has been involved in its history. Do you understand? Do you realize that? Do you realize that? Vietnam was, 9 years? Was it 63 to, well, no, I guess it was longer than that. Well, I don't know. Somebody will look it up for me and send it to me. But our involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq taken together will soon become the longest military engagement that we've ever been involved in. And how many of us pay any attention to it? That's why this program has a military affairs correspondent, specifically Sharon Gordy, because I know that she pays attention to it and will let me know about this stuff. Thanks to Mike for calling in. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us.
Doing talk radio right. From the left, it's more of Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. I got an email from Bob Alexander at prosecutegeorgebush.com at 10:36. It's now 10:50. And about half of the money that he was talking about, 500 and call it 600 bucks, had come in through... you know, very small donations, which is all he's looking for. So keep it up. by the time we get the break, the top of the hour, maybe he'll finish up with the postage and then they can start the stuffing party. I guess he's got people coming over this weekend to put these books and cover letters and explanations in envelopes. The work this guy has done, I mean, And I got a little bit worried, after talking to Mike there, the chaplain from Army, started thinking about what Bob sent me in an email, a couple weeks ago, about cross-referencing all these names of all these dead soldiers and Marines. 40, I'm not trying to play loose with the facts here, I don't know, 4,600 people, American soldiers and Marines have died, been killed as a result of Bush and Cheney's lies. But the point is, Bob had to get the list of the dead, the names, and cross-reference these people with their hometowns and then their home county in order to get the county prosecutor. Now, whereas 90% of America pays zero attention to the military or the especially the dead soldiers, the other 10% are people who are directly or indirectly involved through family. Bob, on the other hand, and Jude, and I assume Jude helped, or Minda maybe, but Bob especially, sitting there with the names of the dead, specific names, and matching them to their specific home county, and then locating the name of the specific county prosecutor and addressing the letter and explaining what this was all about. You can't, as Mike was just saying, the former chaplain, and I even wrote to Bob and I said, you know, or to Jude, one of them. And I said, you know, you're staring too deeply into the abyss. You got to be careful. But that's what Bob has done. Every single name of every single soldier and Marine flowed through Bob Alexander's consciousness to the extent that he had to link that dead person up with the county prosecutor and address a book to that prosecutor. I mean, just think about that for a second, if you would. I mean, just maybe you better not. So, if he's a couple of hundred bucks shy of having the postage, again, if I can get 100 people, send $2. I mean, whatever. Go to prosecutegeorgebush.com. There's a PayPal button there. Just throw a little in the hat. He's almost done with this. And this is not a deal where when he's all finished with this, he can take a week off and, you know, go to Hawaii. Even though he used to live there. No, he can't. I mean, you know, he can't do it. This was something that Bob Alexander, it was a lightning bolt that hit him about doing this. I mean, nobody, you know, he heard Bugliosi on this program. He may have found it independent of this program, but he heard Bugliosi, the interview, and got the book and read it, and then had one of those moments where at the moment that you have the moment, it feels like an epiphany and you know exactly what to do. 6 months later, when you have just been fried and drained and beat to hell from what seemed like an epiphanous moment at the beginning, and it was, it leaves you exhausted. I have done maybe one or two things like this in my entire life. Not books, not prosecutors, not going through the names of the dead. But I'm talking about something that in the moment says, Jesus, I got to do this. Yeah, I can do this. And then 6 months later, you're going, oh, my God. He doesn't get a break when this is over. So, you know. Couple of bucks. Just throw it in the hat. We're not talking big money here. So, you know, And if you hear of a county prosecutor who brings charges, you'll have a pretty damn good idea where it came from. To your phone calls, James is calling from Seattle, listening on. Where are you listening to? How you listen to the show, James?
Oh, hi. How are you? Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, you listen on the radio or internet or what?
Internet, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I wanted to, the gentleman, Mike, that came on, it wasn't my original intent to say this, but since I was listening, I heard this. I just kind of wanted to plug for an organization called Iraq Veterans Against the War.
Yeah, we've talked about them a lot. I've quoted my military affairs correspondent keeps me pretty close to what that group is doing.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, yeah. So my original kind of comment and discussion was about the Federal Reserve System. When we talk about regulations of companies, and that's why this mess financially.
Right.
The Austrian school of hard money economics. There are numerous Austrian hard money economists that predicted this would happen 25 years ago, and it's not that they were clairvoyant. It's just that they understood the mechanics of the market, and their predictions were based on the fact that. It's not so much the regulation of the private sector that we need, but the regulation of the Federal Reserve that we need.
Well, you know, I've had a lot of people, James, suggest that the Federal Reserve should be, metaphorically speaking, just blown up, that it serves no function whatsoever except to impede whatever good comes from commerce. James, I have to leave it there. Thanks. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program on Nova M Radio. Let's go right back to your phone calls. And by the way, we have a bunch of open lines now. 800-989-1480 is the number. 800-989-1480. Dick is calling from Seattle, listening on KPTK. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Mike, sitting here drinking beer waiting to go on, so I guess I'm ready for prime time now.
There you go.
Hey, that good German beer smells
yeah,
like
that'll do it to you. That'll do it to you, yeah.
Hey, look, a few weeks ago you made a reference to the House and Senate investigations that we had in the mid-70s, you know, the ones under Otis Pike in the House and Frank Church in the Senate.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they were looking into the CIA criminal activities. But what I found even more revealing is how these investigations were blocked and sabotaged, along with the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation, which was ongoing about 2 years later. And what this showed was how the Republicans and the executive branch and the intelligence services and, of course, their mainstream media could all work together to subvert, you know, not only the interests of the people, but their representatives' careers that were trying to have these investigations,
right,
if they tried, you know, to have an honest one and look into the crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's now been, what, 30 years since then without any meaningful congressional investigation since, assuming, you know, you don't count the Iran-Contra or
right,
this whitewash of 9/11, this Warren Commission they had there. So I think that's the important part to know what happened, because this is what we have to deal with again now. And there are a couple books that go into the details of this sabotage of justice I thought your listeners might want to be aware of, and because they're not well known. One is by Catherine Olmsted. It's called Challenging the Secret Government, the Post-Watergate Investigations of the CIA and the FBI. And that'll give you a great background on this, what happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, another good book is on the media called Into the Buzzsaw, that exposes this myth of a free, objective media, the one, you know, that keeps us so confused, you know, with
sure,
all the spin and propaganda. And it's edited by Christina Borgeson. So we have to learn about who our enemy is, and it starts with the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
pardon me?
Nothing, go ahead.
I heard the other evening that you were getting a little discouraged, and I think part of the reason might have been that you still have expectations, maybe even high expectations, that the media will do its job, and I think we can pretty well dismiss them as being anything except the opposition.
Yeah, well, I said the other night, that night that you're referring to, it was a momentary lapse of reason, Dick, because every once in a while I honestly do believe that what is really a very small cadre of true journalists, and they do exist, is in fact a majority of journalists, which it's not. I have great respect for the writers out there who are still writing. Everybody from Paul Krugman, who is not really a journalist, but you understand what I'm saying, to Mark Morford at the Chronicle, who is not really a journalist, but you understand what I'm saying. These are writers. These are opinion op-ed writers or whatever. As far as journalists per se, in some instances, Bob Woodward, but he is too close to power. He's, you know. What would you call Frank Rich? I don't know. What is Maureen Dowd? What is Bob Herbert? I don't know how to identify these people anymore. They are involved in the profession of journalism, but they are not writing news. They are. They're writing opinion pieces. Eric Zorn, another example from the Chicago Tribune. Journalism as a protected profession, protected by the First Amendment, has really, really destroyed us. And by destroyed us, I mean by not giving us the information that we desperately need to be an informed group of people who are still trying the experiment of self-government, right? We are not being given the information. We just aren't. We aren't. I mentioned this the other night. Someone, I think it was an op-ed piece in the Times yesterday, New York Times, suggesting that because of the state of economic state that so many newspaper corporations are finding themselves in, just like any other corporation, and they're cutting staff, they're cutting their overseas bureaus, they're cutting their writers here at home. A lot of people say, well, so what? You're contradicting yourself, Malloy. You just said they were worthless. Well, one of the reasons they're worthless is because they have to cut so much good staff. Advertising revenue is disappearing. And the suggestion was made that major newspapers, and I'm not sure how the writer was defining major newspapers, but that major newspapers operate from endowments, like major universities operate from endowments. That way they are not dependent upon advertising revenue, A. B, their editorial voice never gets influenced by the advertising department, which does happen. It certainly happens in television. It happens all the time in television. How many times have you heard about a certain a program that was going to be broadcast and the last moment was canceled because, quote, management felt it didn't reflect the best interests of their viewers, which is a bunch of hog farts. It meant that the advertisers on that particular network or station found it offensive or counter to their point of view. So therefore, the piece disappears. Endowments for newspapers? Not a bad idea. Back to your phone calls. Bidia Sanchez is calling from Montebello, California. Hey, Sanchez, listening on KTLK. Hey. How are you?
Yes, I am on KTLK this evening. A very good evening to you, and as much love as I could possibly squeeze through the telephone line back to you guys there.
Yeah, well, Bidia, thank you.
I was calling basically to run some information by you. Did you heard about Michael Steele being elected to?
Yeah, we talked about it earlier, first hour tonight, right?
This is amazing. I find the Sarah Palins of the world come in all sizes, shapes, and colors. Don't you think?
Yeah.
It's the same old here. Did you hear one of his comments that he was making and referring, at least he has a good sense of humor. He seems like he's going to be a good sparring partner for Barack Obama, where Barack Obama was kind of passing him off as a lightweight, and his comeback reply to one of the reporters was, well, how you like me now? Did you hear that?
No, but if that's funny, it just blew right past me.
Well, no, it's just, it's kind of the, like copping an attitude with him, like he's going to be a good sparring partner. It's kind of a catchphrase amongst, like, you know, in the old soul in hip hop.
Well, I think my attitude about his selection is, probably not far removed from your attitude. It smacks of tokenism to me. It smacks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
It smacks of, the same reason they somebody selected Sarah Palin. You know, it's the same old story for the Republicans. If they do get any use out of Michael Steele, as soon as they're finished using him, they'll just pitch him aside.
Well, more importantly, the thing that I found that was lacking in all of that was accountability for the past 8 years. They're just willing to, like, glaze right over it because they want the warm and fuzzy young, the very college-aged Republicans, to feel warm and fuzzy and feel good about conservatism. So I think that's the other and the more important reason why they're presenting themselves as warm and fuzzy and not be even coming close
but you know
to talking
what?
About accountability.
But you know what, Sanchez, that's simply not going to work. And I'll tell you why. These young Republicans are also young racists. They have no alternative but to be racist because that's how they that has been pumped into them since they were even younger.
Mm-hmm.
And not just racist where it concerns African Americans, but where it concerns any hyphenated American who is not perfectly white. That is the legacy of college Republicans. I mean, that's all they have to operate on. That is the gift that their parents gave them. Hey, Sanchez, I got to leave there. Thanks,
of course, man.
Have
a good
one. All right, I appreciate you checking in. Big break. Little break. We'll be back. Let's get some calls in here, damn it. 800-989-1480. Stay with us.
Patriot Speakers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, more of Mike Malloy.
Money's good, work's okay. Looks like everything is rolling. 21 past the hour. All right, back to your phone calls. Ken is calling from Reston, Virginia. Ken, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike. Hi, how are you tonight?
Hey, I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing great. I called with some good news.
Oh, good. Let's hear it.
I'm a 33-year veteran in Steamfitters Local 602 out of Washington, D.C., and I came up with a plan about 4 months ago, back in October, to make a film based on this gentleman has been working on this project since 1994. It's basically a magnetic levitation rail system that would be built out across the United States, the interstate highway system. And it employs basically the functionality of being powered up by solar, 100% solar, and it produces enough hydrogen and power 50 times more than the United States uses in a year, if all 54,000 miles of the Eisenhower Interstate system were built out. It would basically put 30 million people back to work, and it would create a bunch of businesses at each of the traveler stations. That you have to build a traveler station about every 4 or 5 miles. So there'd be businesses generated, jobs generated. The steel industry would be revived. United Auto Workers would be revived. And this gentleman is, I compare him to Michelangelo or Leonardo da Vinci. He's been at this since 1994. He's won numerous awards and been written up in many of the top magazines, but has not gotten the first mile of track laid. And I think we understand why. But anyway, to make a long story short, basically I told him, I think what needs to be done is you need to market this better to get it out there. So I came up with an idea to take it to our union bosses, since we're losing so many union jobs in this country, especially in the auto industry and in the steel industry. I thought it would be a good idea to get these folks to invest in, and I've been a proud union member for 33 years, as I said. So I took this to our union bosses after making a film about it, and they were just completely blown away. I mean, they were like, this is a great idea. And basically, they're sitting, according to the AFL-CIO standards, I mean, their statistics, they're sitting on about $8 trillion in cash in their pension funds all across America, and they're losing their butts every day on Wall Street. So what this system will do is create a lot of jobs for them, and they're going to guarantee them 12.5% return on investment. And so it's just a win-win situation, and I wanted to tell you about it. And we're real close. I was on a conference call the other day with one of the top labor leaders in our country, in the UA, the United Association, which is the first union to endorse Barack Obama, and they just have accolades for this. I mean, this is just something they're going to do it, and if we can get the Democrats to get behind allowing us permission to build on the interstate highway system, we don't need their money. They can keep their money. We've got plenty of it, and I just wanted to let you know that.
Well, I think it's great. I hope something comes of this.
Can I give the website?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I thought, you know, we needed a refreshing bit of good news, you know, in our country, you know, some hope, some optimism. So anyway, the website is www.kenhoward.ws. That's my name. I have that linked to a site that has the film. They can watch it there free of charge. It's an hour and a half film. It's very informative. And like I said, this system addresses multiple issues in our country. It addresses energy. It will basically make us energy independent within the first 3 to 4 years. We would be completely off of foreign oil. After the whole system is built out in 10 years, it'll take about 10 years to build out all 54,000 miles of the interstate highway system.
Good Lord. Now, say the website again, Ken.
It's www.kenhoward, kenhoward.ws. And that stands for website. WS, just like a World Series or a website, whatever you
want. Oh, that's a new, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's another extension.
Ken Howard. KenHoward.ws.
Yes, kenhoward.ws.
Okay, let's.
And Mike, also one more thing. I'm going to have that. Since it is an hour and a half, and I couldn't get it uploaded on to YouTube because they only allow 10-minute segments. I'm going to break that into nine. I've already broken it into nine 10-minute segments. So I'm going to have that uploaded onto YouTube. The name of the film, if they want to research it on YouTube as well, it is Invest in America, Part 1-9.
Okay.
Invest in America. But one quick passing point. This system addresses multiple issues in our country. Energy, this system, once it's completely built out, would produce 50 times more power than our country uses by using the clean solar. And then it takes the excess electricity and reverses the processes and produces hydrogen. And then we could completely fuel our entire fleet.
All right, let me give you the site again. Ken, thanks. I know you had to talk fast on that one. KenHoward.ws. Check out what this man just said. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
And now, a soothing bedtime lullaby. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Email here from Don in Baltimore. Writes, Mike, this bipartisanship thing isn't going to work. I have never seen Republicans do anything except whatever was in their own selfish interests. The Republicans don't give a damn about America. Or the American people. They have done everything possible to destroy our economy, our industrial base, our unions, and on and on and on. Millions are losing their jobs across America and their homes, and losing their jobs and their homes, and so on by the work over the last 28 years of the Republican Party. They fought against every social program ever created. They don't care about America or Americans, and we know it. Obama wants to be a compromiser and work with them for the good of all of us Americans. It's not going to work and never will with Republicans unless you pay them like the rich friends do. Obama needs to take the bull by the horns and say, this is what we have to do, and we have to do it now to bring this nation back from the brink of total disaster. He needs to tell the Republicans, you can help if you want, or stand aside and let us fix this disaster now. No more political games. Don in Baltimore. I don't think that's Barack Obama's style. He is not George W. Bush. Oh, really? He seeks reconciliation. I won't say compromise, because he's made it very clear on certain issues he does not compromise. But he's trying. I think he's trying something that we may be, historically speaking, beyond, and that is real reconciliation between and among all the different competing political factions in this country. The right wing of this country, the political right wing, and the right wing that is such a cancer on the media, and specific right wingers, like Limbaugh, of course, have done so much incalculable damage. Not just to the dialogue that Americans should be having, but also to the sense of confidence or trust or belief. They have destroyed whatever ethical center may have been developing in this country. This is what the right wing has done, and I think this is essentially what Don was saying. Barack Obama understands this on the one hand, but I think on the other hand, he is attempting what could be the impossible. It could be something that beyond which we've come to the point where we can't go back, and that is to find common ground. Finding common ground has always been a position that is sought by groups who have been oppressed. If you think back over history, trying to find common ground where disagreements are acknowledged, but agreements can be arrived at to move whatever the agenda is forward. Why is it always people who are representative either not, perhaps not of an oppressed group, but represent that oppressed group? Why does it always come from them? Because they're the ones who understand that power flows down. It does not flow up unless you're talking revolution. Power flows down. The people who have the power have got to be convinced to compromise. You see, it's very simple. People in positions of power, for example, is corporate America seeking compromise? Corporate America is giving us taxpayers, who all of a sudden are being forced to carry the weight of their mistakes, they're giving us the finger, and they're getting away with it. They don't give a goddamn. Why should they compromise? You see, it is not in their consciousness, their makeup, to compromise. So Barack Obama, who had to have learned from his black family members, and possibly, I don't know how adept white parents or grandparents would be at teaching a black male what caution he had to use in this society, to prevent him from being hanged or lynched if he lived in a certain part of the country, spat upon or ignored or denigrated or relegated to some subservient position if you live in another part of the country. You understand. If you're black, you understand exactly what I'm talking about. Every black family who has ever had, in America, a black son has never had a day when that black son left the house that black mother and father didn't worry and hope that what they taught him would hold. Back down. If the police come, don't run. If somebody says something to you that makes you want to fight, suck it up, walk on. This is America. This is white America. All right? Now, I don't know how many white people understand that. Probably very few. Black folk understand that perfectly. So, Barack Obama, because he has a black parent and a white parent, is considered in this country by everybody to be an African American. Okay, fair enough. If that's the case, he has learned the lessons that were necessary for black youth in this country to learn in order to survive. Now, some didn't learn it. Some young people, black of color, some black young people took a different tack. The attitude of screw you. You mess with me, I will cut your throat. In fact, I may cut your throat first because I know you're going to screw with me. That's a result of racism. That's a result of, you know, it's got all sorts of reasons for that attitude. All this, everything I just said, leading up to the point that Barack Obama is not the type to be confrontational. It's almost genetic in a man, I don't know about women, of African descent or of African appearance, African-American appearance, whatever you want to call it. It's almost genetically programmed now to find not an area of confrontation, but an area of solution, an area of compromise, not compromising values, compromising tactics, compromising strategies, not values, never values. And for the liberals, of which I include myself, for white people, of which I include myself, maybe what some of us ought to do is just shut up a little bit here. We realize, don't we, that some of the choices, we liberals, forget the white part for a minute, liberals, progressives, realize that Obama may be making some choices that we don't agree with. As a matter of fact, that's too weak. Some choices that we adamantly oppose. On the other hand, now I'll come at it from not a liberal, but a white person. White people cannot get inside a black man's mind and figure out what it is that he's doing, someone who is righteously motivated like Barack Obama is. We can't. If it were Martin Luther King Jr., even that was difficult, but his actions were directly related to his philosophy. Barack Obama is not MLK. Barack Obama is in a position of extreme power. No black man in the history of this country has ever been in the position of power that Barack Obama is in. I think white conservatives understand that, and that's why they're getting so pissy about this. Okay? So I think whites and liberals and white liberals need to understand something here, that we do not know what Barack Obama is attempting to do. We're going to evaluate it based on our own experience with white people and with black people. We're going to say, well, with liberals and conservatives, we're going to say, well, that's not why I voted for him. Now, wait a minute. Take it easy. Take it easy. How long has he been president of the United States? How long has he been the most powerful man, in a manner of speaking, on earth? Think for a second. We listened to the former Army chaplain tonight. Mike, was that his name, Mike? Trying to explain something to us. I don't know how many of us got it. But Barack Obama, do you think that maybe he is trying to process his reality right now? I mean, if he, when he gets up in the morning and says good morning to his wife and kids and looks in the mirror, does he say back to himself yet, Jesus, God, I am the most powerful person on earth, in some very definitive terms? He really is. And B, does he look in the mirror and say, oh my God, I'm the most powerful black man that America's ever produced? Does he? How would you handle that? Could you handle that? Would you have the presence to handle that? I wouldn't. Would you? So, the point of all this, as he makes these choices and selections, he's not coming at this from a position of a house Negro. Now, some of you understand what I mean by that. He's not coming at it from that position. He's coming at all this stuff from a position of absolute understanding, I think, of what he's doing. He does understand. He may not understand the power that's in his hands right now, but he does understand the symbolism of where he's at. He understands it. He's got a better grip on what's going on than any white person in America. Now, white folk have got to understand that. Ten before the hour, I got an email here from Bob Alexander and also one from Jude. You all came through again tonight. You folks amaze me. As Bob puts it, the boat is about to dock, which I think means they may have collected enough money tonight. I think it was around $600-$700 to take care of the remaining amount of postage necessary to get out copies of The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder, Vince Bugliosi's book. So to the people who did go to that website and did contribute, thank you very much. Who knows what's going to come of this, but something may. And at least because of the efforts of Bob and Arminda and Nick, I'm sorry, Bob Armand and Jude. Nick is the child, although he probably contributed here too in terms of the time from his parents. But because of Bob and Armenda and Jude, every single county prosecutor in the United States will not be able to say, I've never heard of Vince Bugliosi's book, one of our fellow prosecutors. I've never heard of his book. So therefore, I didn't know what to do. That now is an historical impossibility. That's pretty profound to me. I mean, that really is. So thanks to everybody who came to the rescue again tonight. That is so cool. And thanks to our crew, Ian Huff, who engineered, Ben Birch, who is our podcast manager. And by the way, the newest Malloy's Uncensored Mailbag is up. At the website, if you are a Nova M founder, subscriber, whatever, and you have the password, go check it out. This is the best, and by that I mean the sickest letter. I've only got one up this time. This one takes the cake. It is astonishing what this guy wrote to me. He even references, in a sleazy kind of way, Kathy in this email. That he sent, but it's up. So go to novamradio.com and click on the member section, podcast member section, and check this one out. We haven't had one up since before Christmas. So, and that's just been dereliction of duty here in the Malloy program. But this is by far the sickest son of a bitch who has ever sent me an email. That's why it's so good. You sick bastards out there, keep it coming. I'm serious. The ones that get through my staff filtering mechanism only get through because they are so degenerate. So, you know, keep them coming, and we'll keep posting them out there. And eventually they'll probably all wind up on YouTube along with your email address. So, anyway. So, thanks to Ian Hoff, who engineered, Ben Birch, who got the new Malloy's Uncensored Mailbag up today and is also the network's technical advisor. Our military affairs correspondent tonight, Sharon Gordy. Bob Alexander, whom you certainly know. Bridget Wolf, whom you know, our ethical advisors. Bruce Enberg, our economic correspondent. And the executive producer of this program is Catherine Bay. Do we have time to? Yeah, we do. All right. How about Dan, who is listening on 92.1 The Mic in Franksville, Wisconsin. Hey, Dan.
Hey, I think I'm one of those sick bastards, sort of, because I drive a truck. And if you drive a truck, you're exposed to, like, stuff like that. So if you're exposed to it, it sort of degrades you, and then you're sort of in that group, whether you like it or not, right?
No, not really.
Yeah, I think so.
But I understand what you're saying.
Like, your show, taking a turn here a little bit. I won't get too involved in the gore, but there's a guy named a guy that drives a truck on the I-90 corridor, and he's from Iraq. And it took about 15 or 20 minutes. I was talking to him, and I'm a Vietnam era veteran, and I just a lot of these guys, they hold it in. But this guy, after I talked a little bit, explained, you know, how I was upset with the government about using people and the stuff that you're exposed to in guerrilla warfare and stuff. He opened right up, and that's usually a lot of chatter on that radio. Some of the roughest radios on Channel 19, because you can't turn channels or you can't say next caller. So when people go at it, you have to. But that's a chattery corridor there, because there's a lot of traffic going to the west. But it was quiet when we talked. When he got going, all hell broke. Hell came out of his mouth when he started going, because we're just talking about just death that you can't. I mean, there was no talk. I mean, for an hour straight, where this guy was going on with the stuff in Iraq, that corridor was quiet. There was only me and him talking, and me prompting him on stuff. And
wait a minute. What is Channel 19? You talk about CB channel?
Yeah, GM 19. Okay. Yep, it's a that's what the truckers use. And in California, they use something for the northern part and the southern part because Californians are different. But everything's 19, you know. Mm-hmm. But it was when he got cranked up. He's sort of a racist, but he's just a young guy, 23, you know. And he's I can't, people grow up with parents and stuff like that. They've been programmed, so I can't really blame him. He's a nice guy, but he's sort of racist. But
right.
When he opened up on this stuff with Iraq, you know, when I said, these people don't wear beanie caps, the enemy in these warfares. When you go in, when people are fighting at you, it's death. Like he was saying, he says, I ordered in a bulldozer. Everyone, kids, everything was done. They're dead.
God.
They're
just,
like nothing. And this went on for, and that's what I mean, there was no talk
mm-hmm.
at all. Once he got opened up, and I mean, the people that were listening were must have been like, oh, my God.
I hear you. Dan, hey, listen, man, you need to call in again because I do want to hear more of what you got to say, but we are flat out of time, pal, so I would like to hear more of that tonight. I sure would. Take it easy. Take it easy. All right? I'll see you Monday, True Seekers. Thanks for hanging out this week and especially tonight. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. This is Nova M, and oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Have a great weekend, Kevin Kinney, wherever you are.